The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to our Tuesday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in, and it is great to be here. Let's run through our announcements. You can give us a call and talk to our guest, who I will introduce in just a minute, Sean Casey. The toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Do be patient when it's ringing. We'll answer it and bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also use email to reach us with your comments or questions. And the email address for tonight is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then please also remember that we're a trademarked and copyrighted program, and you're free to download our programs and share them and pass them around. A 90-minute program is roughly 40 megabytes. And if you need to know how to do that, please send me a note, and I'll be happy to tell you how to send out a 40-megabyte file. But please don't do anything commercial, and no edits, no private YouTube channels or website cuts or edits or anything of that nature. And we don't do written transcripts, even if they're for your own permission, for your own use. But if you do have a certain idea or a use in mind for a space show program, or something you've heard on a space show program, go ahead and email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com, and let's see if we can work it out together, and I'd be happy to hear from you. Our website is thespaceshow.com, so there you'll find the detailed and comprehensive website newsletter. It has all of the programs in detail on the website for the week. It has all of the guest bios. It's the only place you'll find a future events section for the space show, and then if we have to make program changes during the week, you will find them first on the website newsletter. So to stay current, please do check it from time to time. If you want the very short email newsletter sent to you early Monday morning via email, California time, please send me your email address at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Everything we do going back to 2001 is archived on our site. You can easily download the shows, or you can listen right off of our site. You'll also, in the middle of the page, see the guest search tool. I'm trying to get more and more of you to use it. But there you can do global searches just as you would an Excel file or a Word file or a PDF file. You can search for your favorite term, like microgravity, for example, or your favorite guest. You'll get all of the dates where that term or that guest appeared on the space show. Jot them down, and then you can use our search engine at the bottom of our homepage to pull up all of those shows, as our search engine works by date. Yes, I wish it was an interactive site, but it is not. Maybe someday we'll be able to do that. Do use guest search if you want to find out if a certain subject or a certain person has been on the space show. We have a story. You'll see it up near the top. It's called Space Show Gear. As we move into the holiday period, hopefully you'll take some time and check it out, visit it. Maybe there'll be some items there that work for you and those on your gift list. And the most important button is the Support the Space Show button. And remember, we are a nonprofit 501c3 with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And we're existing because many of you do support us. We're deeply appreciative of that and of those of you who will be supporting us. Remember, if you're paying federal U.S. taxes, you're entitled to a tax deduction, and the same if you pay California taxes. We do podcasts, and we thank Andrew over at gigadial.net for our podcasting service. You can hear us through iTunes, Podcast Alley, astrospacenow.com, yastro.com, and, of course, Microsoft Zoom. If you have any questions on the podcast, get a hold of me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And finally, do remember that we are brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation. Secure World Foundation promotes cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, you can visit their website, www.swfound.org. And Secure World is the sponsor of our webinar series. We have a webinar this Sunday after Thanksgiving with Dan Adamo and Dr. Jurist. And it'll have a lot to do with Earth Moon L2 and how you get there and plan missions for there. So you definitely want to see that one webinar. And again, thanks to Secure World Foundation for making our webinars possible. I'm very happy to bring back to the Space Show tonight one of our favorite guests who's been on the program for many, many years with us, and I'm talking about Dr. Sean Casey, who has co-founded a new group which we're going to talk about, the Silicon Valley Space Center, which is a nonprofit business accelerator focused on connecting entrepreneurs with the new space industry. Before that, he had spent 15 years serving as a senior scientist with University Space Research Associates for NASA's SOFIA project. We'll get an update on SOFIA before we go into what's happening down in the valley. His bio is on the website, but he has, of course, a lot of different degrees. But I asked him before the show about his joint degree with UC Cal's Haas Business School and the Columbia School of Business for an MBA. They don't offer that program anymore, but he got to go back and forth between Berkeley and New York and got degrees from both of those schools, got an MBA, and what a cool program. I wish that had been around when I was doing my MBA program years and years ago. Anyway, Sean, welcome back to the Space Show, and always good to talk to you and find out what's going on. Why don't we start with getting at least some kind of an update on what's happening with SOFIA?
Oh, great. Thank you very much, David. Yeah, I've usually on the show talking about SOFIA, but today I'd really like to talk about our Silicon Valley Space Center that's been going on. But just for an update, for people that are concerned about SOFIA or interested in SOFIA, you know, it's really a great program, and they're starting this year, they're starting their Cycle 1 science program, so proposals were submitted over the last year and reviewed, and they're now scheduled. There's going to be a second call for science proposals later on during the summer, and I would refer everybody to the SOFIA webpage, which is www.sofia.usra.edu. There you'll find lots of news on recent results, certainly from our basic science program, and then also current status of the observatory and opportunities for future proposal calls. It's a fantastic facility that's flying out of Palmdale at Dryden's aircraft, their day off facility, which is the Dryden operational research facility just south of where Dryden Flight Research Center is. But it's a program that's going to have a very healthy life, and we should all look forward to seeing results that are going to come out of SOFIA. So people should refer to the webpage and updates that are posted there on the program.
NASA is responsible for operating the plane and the pilots and the maintenance and crews. Is that correct?
Oh, right. Yeah, the operations is split currently between Dryden and NASA Ames, where the Dryden Flight Research Center has responsibility for operation of the aircraft, and NASA Ames has responsibility for science part of the program. And just recently, during the summer, there was an announcement of a upgrade for one of the far infrared cameras, the Hawk instrument, and that is actually on its way down to JPL to be converted from its original design of a photometer into a polarimeter. And so far infrared polarimetric observations are going to be a key component of SOFIA as the observatory moves forward. I also expect that there'll be another call for science instruments probably in a couple of years. So people that are interested in SOFIA upgrades and next-generation instruments should really look to the future, just in the short term, about proposal opportunities for the observatory.
Now, it's also a joint project with the German space program,
oh, right.
Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So
yeah,
say a word about that, too.
Yeah, well, thanks for reminding me about that. I just, you know, you always are, everyone's focused on the NASA meatball, but it is a joint project between the U.S. and German space agencies, and Deutsches Zentrum für Luft- und Raumfahrt, DLR, is 20% partner on the program. And so in contributing to funding for the effort, the German community gets 20% of the telescope time. And one of the key instruments that's flying right now is the Great Spectrometer. And they've had some recent results on molecular line detections that people can read about on the SOFIA website. And that is actually a no pun intended, a great instrument, because since their last observing run, they were able to upgrade components of the instruments to bring in the latest and greatest in detectors and an upgrade to the local oscillator for the system. And it really takes advantage of SOFIA as a hands-on airborne platform, with SOFIA expected to spend its time flying around at the bottom of the stratosphere at 41 to 45 thousand feet and doing observations that you cannot do from the ground between, you know, almost at a core wavelength regime of 30 to 300 microns. It goes longer and it goes shorter, but 30 to 300 is stuff that you just cannot do from the ground. Even 10 and 20 is difficult to do from ground-based sites like Mauna Kea or places like the South Pole.
And it stays airborne for quite a while at one time, right?
Yeah, those flights are 8 to 10 hours. And, you know, I was on a flight during the summer, last summer, where we did the Pluto occultation with Ted Dunham's group down at Lowell and in partnership with his collaborators out at MIT. And that was a very unique observation where you try and fly to the center of an occultation shadow that's projected onto the Earth. And from the details of that transition spectrum, you can tell something about the residual atmosphere that may or may not be around Pluto as a dwarf planet. You know, its orbit is slightly anomalous. It's not like the other planets. Actually moves inside the orbit of Neptune, and when it does that, the system warms up and any frozen ices on the surface of Pluto sublimate and form a residual atmosphere. And that atmosphere probably dates back to the earliest stages of our solar system. And it's a very unique observation that only an airborne platform can really do. I mean, there are people on the ground that do transit observations, but with an airborne platform, you can fly directly into the center of the shadow. And then because of refractive effects due to the atmosphere of the planet, you actually see a central peak. So you'll a transit is where a solar system object moves in front of a background star, and then that projects a shadow through the solar system, and then our Earth moves quickly through that shadow, and you have to be in the right place on the globe to see the transit event, and then to see the refraction effect, which is at the center of the transit as the starlight winks off and then winks on. You really have to be at the center of that shadow. It's a very important observation that was done, for instance, on the Kuiper Airborne Observatory very early on, where they discovered the rings of Uranus by watching the occultation before the event actually occurred. They saw the starlight wink off temporarily, and because they were on an airborne platform and they could extend the leg, they extended it beyond where the starlight winked on, winked back on again, and then they also saw the telltale signature of a ring transiting the starlight. So you saw starlight turn off temporarily, and then there was the big transit event, and then when you stayed on the leg and continued the observations, you saw the other side of the ring. And that was totally unexpected, and it was only because you had people in the loop that you were able to successfully make that observation. Had it been planned, or had, you know, scientists not been there, being available to do an instant analysis of what they were seeing, they might have completely missed it. So, and all of that was discovered before Voyager had made it to the outer planets, and then Voyager was able to reconfirm that ring structure.
Does the pilot need special training to fly these missions? How is that done? I mean, normally the pilot knows how to fly the plane, obviously.
The pilot is all NASA. I mean, all the pilots come from the NASA pool, and we've had a variety of pilots that have come through the program. But the pilots from Dryden are very dedicated, and there have been some upgrades to instrumentation in the cockpit, but some of that was to take advantage of latest and greatest in flight electronics, and was required by FAA and flight regulations. But it normally flies, you know, not being a pilot, from what I hear from the guys up on the flight deck, it handles like a regular 747, but I would say that flying on the airplane, you can definitely tell that there's a big old telescope in the back of the airplane. It just feels like it's tilted. That just might be an unfounded sensation, that, but that was just kind of my comment. And it's also, Sophia's a lot more comfortable than flying around the KAO. You know, I've done a lot of flights on the KAO, and I found that Sophia was just it might just be the first class seats that they have up in the forward section of the airplane, but it's really a great facility and should have a very long and happy lifetime over, hopefully the next 20 years, if not beyond.
So let's go from the Airborne Observatory back down to ground on Silicon Valley. So
sure.
You started a business incubator, right?
Yes, we have we imagine this as functioning as a business league here in Silicon Valley, and it also functions as a business accelerator for startups and entrepreneurs. I mean, our vision for what's going to happen in the 21st century is the ubiquity of spaceflight, and I think we're starting to see some of that now for people that are directly involved in the industry. But it's not just governmental programs that you see, but an increase in academic participation and even industries at the almost at the state level, where if you look out, you'll see that we've got the Mojave Spaceport. Just the other week, I was talking to the guys down at Spaceport America. They had a great meeting down there for the International Personal Spaceflight Symposium that they organize in October on an annual basis. Just recently, I was down in Florida, and Space Florida has their programs going on. And recently, I heard about the Colorado effort to develop their spaceport, and even a spaceport in Georgia that I had not heard about, and just picked up some recent information on. And of course, there's also the Mid-Atlantic Spaceport, Mid-Atlantic Regional Spaceport, which I think is called MARS, which is out on Wallops. And that's been upgraded, and so I believe Orbital is doing their COTS program from there.
Right.
But, as you look out, you really start to see that it's not just federal programs, federal space program, but almost at the state level. And then at that level, you also just see a variety of university programs that are involved in space. A very interesting program I find is the QB50 effort. And QB50 is run out of the Von Karman Institute, and it's 50 CubeSats that are intended to fly as part of a ESA mission. And it's for CubeSats, we can talk a little bit more about that as well, but those are 50 separate CubeSats that are built by university participants on a global scale. And last I heard, they had hundreds of interested parties that wanted to participate in this 50-slot program. And that experiment is it's doing one joint experiment that ESA is funding, and then in addition to the collective experiment, each participating university or industry partner has an opportunity to fly some other technology that they want as part of the 50 CubeSats that they're going to fly. Earlier this summer, we had a interplanetary CubeSat workshop, and so I think, you know, with small payloads, you're seeing a lot of university participation and industry participation, and that's kind of what we've been focused on, is the entrepreneurial efforts in Silicon Valley and those that relate to the new space industry.
So would you say it's finally come of age, or it's in the process of coming of age?
It's in the process of coming to age. I mean, it's still, you can just see it developing, and I would say it's continuing to gain momentum. With each year, you're seeing more and more effort. We had a presentation out here. We organized an event with the MIT Stanford Venture Lab program, and people can find it on the web if they search for MIT Stanford Venture Lab and then type in commercial space in addition to that. And it was an event that was held in September of 2011, and we organized, it was a panel discussion on what has been called space economic development zones.
Yeah, I was at that. That's the one I was attended
at
Stanford University, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. And for that, we had, the way we had a lot of discussion about how should we have this event? What should this event look like? Should it look like payloads, or should it look like vehicles? And I had heard a comment from Bob Richards. Bob will talk about economic development zones. And I thought that was a great way to organize the evening. And so the four economic development zones were suborbital, orbital, geostationary, and lunar. And it's economic development zones as a distance from the center of the Earth. And so for those four areas, we had, for suborbital, we had Will Pomerantz from Virgin Galactic. We had Rick Purnell from NanoRacks talking about orbital, and actually Rich gave a very nice presentation about NanoRacks as a company and the kinds of services they offer for delivering payloads up to the ISS. We had Al Todros from Loral talking about secondary payloads to geostationary orbits, which I believe is now an offering through NASA's proposal process, or they're at least entertaining secondary science payloads. And Bob Richards talking about Moon Express, and Amaresh Kalapara headed up, served as the moderator for that discussion, and Amaresh is part of the Space Angels group, which is, you can just see these guys getting more and more traction with startup funding, and so it was actually a very interesting event, and it's on the web so that people can look at it and download it, but it's what. You know, you look at that, that was a year ago, and all of that's continuing to develop.
Do they have any more events like that planned coming up?
Well, we had, it was a very successful event for us, and I've had some discussions with our organizing committee about doing another event in 2013. So afterwards, we were invited back to do another event, but we didn't want to, do one so quickly after the last one, but I think September of 2013 is probably the right time to hit that topic again, and we'll have to figure out exactly what to present. But it was a well-intended, the community responded well to the event, because here in Silicon Valley, not only is it the technologists, but also the financial and investment interests, and that was the intent of the presentation, was to bring to Silicon Valley what's happening in this industry.
You have your an initial question coming in by email from our friend Todd, who is in San Diego, California, and he says, "Are you attempting to match people doing things in new space with money sources in Silicon Valley? Is that the goal? If so, what do the money sources look for out of new space?
Yeah, well, we have, as part of our mission, is the connection of entrepreneurs with the new space industry and with the acceleration of the business planning process. So here, you know, we've been working with a couple of groups in terms of what I would call the lean startup ideology. And it's not only just for for-profit companies, but also, you know, my own interest is in for-profit and non-profit new space endeavors. So within our Silicon Valley Space Center, we have an overall startup package for entrepreneurs that we've been developing, and that includes, you know, business plans and working on financials and pitch decks, elevator pitches, and then connections with the technical and financial communities here in Silicon Valley. So we have a partnership directly with ORIC as a attorneys to help with the incorporation process, and then we also have connections with PR groups and you know, various analysts out here, you know, in the Bay Area and elsewhere. So, and I think on the finance side, you're starting to see investment warm up to this. You know, that the there are a lot of other activities that have certainly been happening. I mean, big news was Planetary Resources and their ability to secure funding from some of the Google founders. And I just, you know, in going to the Space Angel events and talking to people, we're just starting to see more of that. So, and it's, you know, you want to have a good business plan. You want to make sure that you really understand who your customers are and how you're going to turn a profit on this. And that's something that's something that's been developing. We've actually had good relationships with a couple of companies that have made the press in the last 6 months or so. And you know, I can talk more about that as well.
Here, excuse me, another question. This is from Frank, is in Los Angeles, and he says, I'm on your website. I see that we can become a member and go to meetings. Can you talk a little bit about membership and meetings and what exactly you're talking about from the website?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've got a couple of things that are going on, one of which is at an open level. We have a series of talks that we organize in partnership with the AIAA out here in the Bay Area. And for the last year, we've had a focus on small payload talks, and these are with the AIAA. We're really focused on engineering aspects of those programs, and so those are available here in the Bay Area, and we're working on making people in an online fashion. For the basic membership, we provide news feeds. We're a member of the Commercial Space Flight Federation, and as a member, we get news information from the Commercial Space Flight Federation as to what's happening in the industry, also internships and employment opportunities and a working relationship with a number of new space companies. We also provide to our members the Luro report, which comes from Charles Luro, and we have a number of other commercial space flight sources that we deliver to our basic members. We're working on an enhanced membership that perhaps would provide a subscription to the results of business analysts from the new space industry, and that's a discussion that we've been having, and it's kind of not quite up on the website yet, but that's probably going to come out in 2013, and then we've also had discussions with industry people about industry memberships. So with that, right now we just have our basic membership that provides news information to participants, and then probably will also provide direct access to the talks that we have, which are here in the Bay Area on a variety of topics.
All of them down in the valley, correct?
Yeah, we're based over at the Hacker Dojo, which has been an interesting story. If I could just roll this back a little bit onto the history of the Silicon Valley Space Center, we got a lot of our start at the in working with Team FredNet, and this was all in an article that came out at the beginning of 2012 on Space News. We got a phone call, and they had asked us, tell us about Silicon Valley Space Center, and we kind of went into a little bit of the, where we got our start. But coming out of Team FredNet, we had a very successful proposal and helped Team FredNet win one of the ILDD slots as part of their program. From that, we thought, gee, you know, this was actually very successful. We could probably work with other companies to make this happen, and that's when we started the Silicon Valley Space Center, really as a grassroots level effort. In we incorporated on Valentine's Day in 2011. And since then, over the last year, we've had a series of talks over at the Hacker Dojo in partnership with the AIAA and focused on small payload opportunities. And many of these are documented on our website. But, you know, we featured the PhoneSat, Chris Balschhausen, who was doing the PhoneSat program at NASA Ames. He gave a talk about their effort. We also invited the company Laser Motive that had won the Space Elevator Challenge and had been over at one of the Space Angel events pitching their program. They were doing laser refueling of UAVs, so they gave a talk. We've had some GLXP teams come in. Will Baird from Team Phoenicia gave his breakdown for what they're doing, plus Will Baird is also doing a program of engine tests out here in the Bay Area that people can participate in. And then really focusing on a lot of CubeSat efforts. We had TechEdSat with Aaron Cohen from San Jose State University talking about plug-and-play architectures and their test of a sat phone modem as part of their CubeSat effort. We had GomSpace come in and talk about CubeSat space protocols. The founders of GomSpace happened to be here in the Bay Area, and so we were able to get them. We got Dan Soliden from Valley Christian High School, who was actually talking about their NanoLabs program, and they've actually, in the last year, brought in a number of university participants. And then we had a number of the groups that have successfully crowdfunded their space programs, and that includes Peter Platzer's NanoSatisfy and Tim Benedictus' SkyCube program, and a really interesting program by Zach Manchester, which I think is one of the earliest crowdfunded satellite programs, which is his KickSat effort. And all those guys are out here in the Bay Area. They've crowdfunded their programs, and they're continuing to move forward.
The Bay Area is really a hotbed for a lot of this smaller entrepreneurial activity, isn't it?
Well, it's, you know, it's always been kind of a, certainly a hotbed for entrepreneurship. I mean, I think it's well known for that. And what you're seeing, I mean, what I've been seeing over the last year is with guys like Peter Platzer and Tim Benedictus and Zach Manchester are, you know, these guys successfully going out and getting funding and then planning to operate, operate their CubeSats on a, entrepreneurial basis. So Peter competed in the New Space Business Plan competition in just this summer, and that was kind of a tough competition, and I think there were some fairly evolved companies that were in there that were, for instance, already looking for C-level angel funding, and whereas Peter's NanoSatisfy had just successfully in July done their crowdfunding for Arjusat, and so they're, you know, not really a mature effort, but certainly one that is compelling enough for a business plan competition. So but Peter is continuing to go on and develop NanoSatisfy, and has been getting traction out here in the Bay Area for his company.
I was part of the New Space Business Plan Boot Camp, and I remember Peter's presentations.
Yeah.
And, you know, that in a way, you had real startups like his, you know, real bootstrapping entrepreneurial startups,
yeah.
And you had others that had already been funded to the tune of several million dollars,
right,
by various state government, military, defense, sometimes even NASA funding. So they were beyond the bootstrap, where,
right,
you know, garage, we're just getting started kind of thing. And
yeah.
And they're the ones that won.
Yeah, well, that was the nature of that competition, and you know, so be it. But you know, I think Peter, I worked with Peter during the summer on you know, providing input for what they were doing, and you know, lent my advice on things. And so you know, part of that was, you know, focusing on, you know, who's going to be the business plan competition there. And I would say I was a little bit surprised that, you know, C-level companies that were already looking for millions of dollars in VC funding were interested in a business plan competition that provided $100,000. I mean, it was great that NASA signed up to support this effort, and I really look forward to next year's competition. But it was kind of two different classes of companies that were really involved in the final shootout.
Right. Here's another email, interesting one, going back to another space show program. This is June in Phoenix, and June said, shortly after David did the boot camp for the business plan competition, he brought Dr. Burton Lee back to the program to talk about trends and what's hot and not so hot in Silicon Valley, space, non-space investments. He seemed to indicate that software ruled, hardware was less valuable, that space had a really hard time competing against other kinds of ventures that could do multiples and multiples and multiples better than what a space investment can do. Are you seeing the same kinds of trends and the same kinds of challenges for new space? And if you are, how do you counter them?
Yeah, I think that's there's always going to be, for the investor, opportunity costs. And so, you know, where are they looking? And I think here in California, and certainly in the Bay Area, it's hard to get people's attention when there are so many other competing opportunities. But that is what one has to, quote, match wits with. If you look at a company like, for instance, X-Core, that has recently moved from Mojave to Midland, Texas.
Right.
That's kind of an example of not being able to get, in that case, not being able to get the attention of not really investors, but, you know, at the state level, that, you know, I know for the guys that are down in Mojave, they've always had a tough time going to Sacramento and saying, gee, you know, what can we do to keep these companies here? And X-Core is an example of how, if you're not careful, you'll find companies migrating elsewhere.
So let me interrupt you, because I have a funny story to tell you.
Yeah, okay.
I have gone 6 years in a row to Sacramento to lobby for space policy in this state on California Space Day. So 5 years with the California Space Authority, which is now defunct.
Right.
And this year we did it with AIAA.
Right.
So and it was one day, basically, and it was 2 days, but we had this talk and this whole program with the guys from the state and the governor's office and everything. So somebody asked the top state jobs guy, who was there representing the governor's office, about X-Core, and used it as an example for moving to Texas and also to something else, to Florida. I forget what it was, or something, but it wasn't just to Texas. And what are you doing to hold companies here? And we're not just talking about Boeing,
right,
that also is moving out, and in fact they've announced that now. But also the entrepreneurial companies that have been in California since their beginning and are now starting to go to other states, and they come here and they recruit and all of this. And the guy denied that any of this was going on to our group.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, you talk about having your head up your, you know what. And, I mean, I've heard this for 6 years in a row from Sacramento, Sean. I go for entertainment purposes now. I don't know what to make of it. How can they be in denial like this?
I think what you can make of it is if you're a city like Midland, Texas, you can be a player in the new space arena.
Absolutely.
Right.
Because absolutely.
I talked to them in the New Mexico conference. They had their representative there. And he said, you know, they just collect some taxes and they've got a pool of money that they can throw around, and they hired a consultant to say, what kind of industry should we be bringing here? And the consultant brought X-Corps as a company to the table and said, you guys should look at this. And lo and behold, now X-Corps is in Midland, Texas. So when I started off saying that space is getting pushed down to the state level, it can be that, you know, a city like Midland, Texas can go lay claim to a company like X-Corps and bring it to their city. So, and, you know, bring the jobs associated with it. As I understand it, that's going to be an R&D facility out there. So, you know, you've got to be able to compete against the other interests. And it is true that your listener, I think it was down in Las Vegas or someplace, was saying, you know, how do you compete?
Phoenix.
How do you compete against the noise? Well, you've just got to figure out how to do that, and you've got to tell a compelling story. So there are companies like Skybox that are out here that have been able to pull down what I believe is, you know, $100 million of investment, but they're looking to add value. They're doing sky imaging, and they're looking to add value to the images that they get, and they don't see themselves as a space company, as they see themselves as a internet information provider.
Right, and
company.
Here, you mentioned Georgia earlier on too, and so at AIAA in Pasadena, just by chance, for two lunches in a row, I sit next to the retired military guy who's running the Georgia spaceport. So I hope to bring him on the show when he's ready to talk publicly. But he's bringing businesses to Georgia for their spaceport, which they believe will be able to go orbital, because if you look at a map, Georgia swings out and goes toward the Atlantic, and there's no debris field over land. So I'm telling you, these states, when you say at the state level, you're exactly right.
Right.
They smell business and money and jobs and everything that we hear talking about in the economy coming from this community, and they're eager to get a piece of it.
Right, and that it's not just, I mean, I wouldn't say it's not just, you know, big defense contractors.
No,
I mean, certainly
it's
there's
X-Corps
of
the world.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's the small startups that are going to create jobs. And, you know, you're going to see New Mexico competing with Colorado, competing with Mojave, competing with Florida. And, you know, how can you develop what is an ecosystem that is good for entrepreneurs? And that's, you know, if you look at, you know, where the money is, I mean, there's tons of investment capital out here in Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley leads the country, if not everywhere else, in terms of angel and VC opportunities. But if you go to a place like Florida, you know, you don't have as much noise associated with social networking and some of these other industries that Bert and Lee would point out to distract investors. And, you know, angel investing is local. You know, you'd like to bring a company to your backyard. And if I look at some of the GLXP teams, you know, there are some lead teams like Moon Express and Astrobotic that are well known, but there's some other ones. For instance, Michael Paul at the Penn State team and Joe Pelea down at Omega Envoy, who is a part of the University of Central Florida. And those guys, you know, Michael Paul can tap into the Penn State community and say, you know, we're going to do our own state-run lunar mission team. And likewise with Joe Pelea down at Omega Envoy in Orlando, you know, he's actually on the UCF incubator he's actually at the research park at the University of Central Florida, and is part of the incubator program down there. And you know, where does that, you know, Florida can have its own space program. Omega Envoy is uses resources that are from UCF and FIT, Florida Institute of Technology, and Emory-Riddle down there. It's at a very local level, and same with Penn State. It's using local expertise. And if you look at the market for that, Omega Envoy just signed a $1.6 million, I think they have a press release, of a $1.6 million deal with a Chilean group that wants to deliver their rover to the moon. And Omega Envoy is looking to sign up additional customers. Astrobotic, last time I checked, had signed up a number of payload slots, and I believe that's the case for some of these other teams. So, and I suspect the going rate is about $1.5 million per kilogram. So, and when you look at CubeSats, a 1U CubeSat is, you know, it's about 1 kilogram.
Fascinating. Mm-hmm. How the world is changing. We're halfway through. Let's take our pause, and we'll come back. And listeners, happy to get your email questions. But, of course, the phones always work better. 1-866-687-7223. And we'll be back with Dr. Casey in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. We're into part two of our Tuesday evening Space Show program. Our guest today, Dr. Sean, I was going to say Sean Connery. I'm thinking of the James Bond movie. do you get confused? Yeah, does anyone do that to you?
I don't do a very good Scottish accent.
Anyway, I have a clarification question, because before listeners get too wound up thinking we're talking California only, clarify for me. Silicon Valley is in California. But, you know, people come here from all over the world,
right,
for investment savvy, assistance, money. And these guys look at investments all over the world. Borders are fungible to Silicon Valley. Am I correct in this?
You know, that's the case. If you look at things like Draper, Fisher, Jurvetson,
right,
they have offices all around the world. And if you look at things like the Founders Institute, we talked a little bit about the Hacker Dojo. A number of the people that are that frequent the Hacker Dojos are graduates of the Founders Institute, and the Founders Institute is almost like a startup university where you can go and learn about startups. And Founders Institute is pretty much all over. They do their courses throughout Europe and South America, and so, you know, you have a lot of people that are going out from Silicon Valley and looking for investments elsewhere, and that can be at the VC level. But I think at the angel level, it's my own reading on it is that angel investments are local, and that if you're going to get investment help from people, you want to have people that are going to be smart customers and provide value to your team and not just take money from anywhere. And that could be even within crowdsourcing efforts, crowdsourcing funding. The guys that Peter Plotzer and Tim Benedictus and Zach Manchester, when they did their crowdfunding, that was crowdfunding of a service. They under Kickstarter, you say, hey, here's my product, here's what I'm going to deliver to you, and people do an advance purchase of that product. It's not really crowdfunding of the investments, and I know people have been pretty excited by it, but it might be that as you make your way up the funding food chain, that if you had crowdfunded your investments, I've heard it from some people, they're like they might steer clear of that. So you've got to have a pretty clean approach to funding your company.
Who are some of the companies you work for? Can you give us some ideas? Are you limited to focusing on CubeSats, or are you going beyond that?
Well, I would say that we look at, I have my own, background in physics and astronomy, and so I try and kind of stay in the lane of things that I understand, but rather than focus on just hardware stuff, I mean, we're, looking at software, and one effort that we've actually been that we're getting really excited about is an effort called Vital Space, and that's headed up by Ravi Komatureddy, who's a MD down at the Scripps Institute. And Ravi, I've worked with Ravi quite a bit over the last couple of years, and we just completed a flight series on NASA's, as part of NASA's Flight Opportunities Program, to do zero G flights down at Ellington Field on the zero G aircraft as part of NASA's program. And to do that, you've got to be talking about technology that not only benefits NASA, figures into the NASA roadmap, but then in our case also has some commercial potential. And so Ravi serves as the COO for the company, and I'm a co-founder with Ravi on that Vital Space effort. But with Ravi is Dr. Patty Barrett. Patty is a cardiologist down at Scripps, and Ravi is one of the MD researchers down there. And we've been migrating next generation clinical wireless technology into the suborbital and orbital realm, and that is, the Vital Space is not really hardware developer, but it's really talking about the software and the analytics associated with measuring people on suborbital and orbital platforms. And we did that flight series in partnership with Brian Shiro and Jason Reimiller from Astronauts for Hire, and they were serving as kind of the pool of participants. And Vital Space is intended to develop software that allows you to monitor suborbital and orbital passengers during their training and also during their flight experience. And so that's actually gotten some press out of, I think it's in the most recent issue of Thruster from New Space Global, which is a company started by Richard David out of New York.
Yeah, he's been on the show before.
Yeah. Right, and so Ravi is featured, I think, in the November issue for the Vital Space company, and it actually got a lot of press down in San Diego, and so we've been working on the software development. So it's not really a CubeSat program, but it's software, and let's say I'm also advising a company called Positron Dynamics, which actually spun out of the Team FredNet effort. It's headed by Ryan Weed, who is a recent PhD in particle physics from Australia, and in the spring they got funding from Peter Thiel's Breakout Labs group, and for the summer here they've been setting up a lab to develop a positron moderator with applications for non-destructive testing and perhaps medical imaging and then even next-generation engine technologies. That the last one is needs. I mean, it's very low TRL, and right now we're just working on the proof of concept for the solid-state moderator design and Ryan and his collaborator Josh are working on the modeling and expect to have things up and running in the next 6 months or so for their Menlo Park lab. It's right across from the tech shop. So, that was something where I think on some of these companies they have ground-based, earth-based applications, but we're also looking towards how they can be applicable for the new space industry so that they're kind of dual-use technology. And as I mentioned, we'd also work with Peter Plotzer for his NanoSatisfy company, and that's, focused on CubeSats. And, Peter is looking very much at, as he presented in the New Space Business Plan competition, it's not just a satellite company, but as part of his ArduSat effort, you can buy time on his satellite, and it has kind of a collective, crowdsourced effort to it, and that later on he can expand his network. And so, where that's going to go is anyone's guess. But it's really looking towards broad participation by a growing community of users, so that it's not just researchers, but even for Peter's group, you had a group of Girl Scouts on the East Coast that bought time, a week of time on his satellite as part of their educational program.
A lot of possibilities that people are only now starting to think about and capitalize on.
What I really liked about Peter's stuff was that he was really just thinking out of the box of what people could do with a small, a CubeSat that's in orbit. And the ArduSat effort, if you look it up on Kickstarter, you'll see that it has cameras, it's got radiation sensors, it's got a spectrometer. It has a wide variety of sensors that are on board. It was even talking about perhaps putting an small atomic clock unit on there. And, with that, you could design a multitude of experiments that you wanted to do. And some of them aren't even experiments, as they're just perhaps fun things to do. So, and that's the kind of thinking that I think the new space industry needs. People ask for the Silicon Valley Space Center, it's like, why are you over at the Hacker Dojo? And to me, we were there working on our ILDD proposal, and it was a great place to work because it was always open. It's got a kitchen, you can have food, you can work on your proposal. And Larry Maloney, who's one of our co-founders of the Silicon Valley Space Center, had suggested to me that we go over to what was the Super Happy Dev House, which is a Silicon Valley phenomenon where hackers get together over a weekend and just work on projects. And I said, Super Happy Dev House, what is that? And I think I mentioned that during my 2011 New Space conference presentation on SDSC. But it was the energy of hackers in Silicon Valley. And when I went to that Dev House meeting, it was held over in the Microsoft offices. It was on a Saturday night. I was going to give one of the lightning talks at 8 p.m. The audience was just full of people. Maybe that's just on a Saturday in Silicon Valley. That's what people do. But Microsoft headquarters were just full of people that were working together in small groups doing software projects. And when I looked at that, I thought, gee, this is the energy that needs to be engaged in new space. That's kind of what you're seeing with some of the DIY efforts. Just a couple of weeks ago, I talked to Jerry Isdale, who has just gotten some DARPA funding that they announced out here for an effort he calls Space Gambit. And we're having a phone call tomorrow to talk about some workshop opportunities for nano labs and CubeSats and DIY efforts. But, you know, this is when we need to have lots of people engaged in space-related topics, and that's as customers, as entrepreneurs, as enthusiasts, and, you know, that's what you see at some of the SEEDS conferences. But people need to figure out how they can get engaged. They can get engaged as a participant through KickSat efforts. If you look at Zach Manchester's ChipSat, where ChipSat is for, you know, a modest price, you can fly a single board that has communications and power and CPU processing on it, and that ends up being your, you know, your satellite program.
And pretty much anyone can do this.
Yeah.
It's being brought down to a really low level for people.
You have to figure out at what level you want to get engaged. If you look at Kickstarter, you can see there are a number of space programs that have been funded on there, and it falls under what Ed Wright calls his, you know, citizen science program.
Right.
And I know he has purchased a number of seats on the X-Core vehicle, and he's interested in getting people to do microgravity experiments. But when you talk to Dan Soliden, you know, he's got a program that he's executing on out here at Valley Christian, where he invites schools to come in and design their ISS microgravity experiments. And if you listen to Don Pettit's talk about ISS science, he has a great talk where he says, what's your intuition about how things behave in a microgravity environment? And I look at that talk, I thought it was a great talk, and it's exactly the point is, how good is your intuition on microgravity? And if you look at how the last 10 years we've spent a ton of money developing nanotech laboratories around the country, that was to develop an intuition for researchers, develop an intuition about how nature behaves on the nanoscale. Sometimes you'll see nature do something, and then later on the theorist will come in and say, oh, well, I can explain that to you, why that actually happens, and all that's very well and good. But you have to be doing experiments. You have to do experiments at the nanoscale to figure out what nature does at the nanoscale, and then you develop physical theories to help explain that, or you have physical theories that make predictions about what happens in the lab. But in the microgravity realm, I think it's the same story, except we don't have a nation full of microgravity laboratories. We have one microgravity laboratory, and that's at the ISS. And if you work with companies like NanoRacks, you can get your payload up to the ISS for a fairly, you know, reasonable cost for a group of people, or even if you're an individual with a desire to make that investment. But, you know, you can pool your resources, and like with the Girl Scout group that has a week of time on Peter Platzer's ArchuSat, you know, they're going to be doing an experiment in space, and doing stuff like that changes people's attitudes about what they should be doing in their career and how they should be envisioning their life going forward. So
how do schools and people find out about this? For example, I'm doing a lecture tomorrow to an advanced placement fifth grade class in Missouri via Skype. Mm-hmm. So this is the second time I've done this, and the teachers, and they all really like space, but they have no idea that their class could possibly be involved in a space project.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What do I tell them? How do I get them to start looking at hands-on, you guys can do things in space, rather than just talk about policy and budgets and SpaceX rockets and stuff like that?
I think there's just a developing spectrum of possibilities on this, whether it's balloon flights. I mean, people have been doing ballooning. You know, they take their small camera system and put it on a balloon and fly it up to 100,000 feet.
We've done a lot of shows with schools on that, yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, if people send me their, if people email me at sean.casey@SiliconValleySpaceCenter.org, one word, then I'll be happy to, you know, direct people in the right places. But, you know, the talks that we've promoted over at the Hacker Dojo have featured, like, Dan and his ISS group on nanolabs. And there's, you know, just NanoRacks had a call for open source technologies through Space Florida. And I think Space Florida is going to pay for rides to the ISS for companies or for individuals that want to do open source technologies that feed into the nanolab environment. And nanolabs or cube labs are, they have the same, if we step back, just CubeSats. What are, I don't know, listeners know what CubeSats are, but it's a, basically a 1 liter volume that's 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters, a 10 centimeter cube. And that's what they call 1U. And when you do a CubeSat, you can have a 1U CubeSat or a 2U CubeSat. What Peter Platzer is flying is I believe he's planning on flying a 1U or a 2U satellite. The QB50 effort is like a 2U set, a 52U elements. And people fly 3U, and I was even listening to some of the JPL guys talk about interplanetary CubeSats where they're talking about a 6U volume. So Cube Labs or Nano Labs are 1U, 2U, 3U volumes that fly on the International Space Station. And with NanoRacks, you can either fly them inside the space station, or I believe they're working on getting them to fly even outside, you know, affixed to the exterior of the International Space Station. And then what are the technologies? There's companies like Celestial Circuits, I believe, that provides some of the Arduino microprocessor designs. Dan Soliden and his group at Valley Christian, they have their own microprocessor designs that they use. And how does all that figure into open source technologies and open source Arduino designs? And, you know, the Arduino is a is an open source board. And you, what you're seeing is the development of open source space hardware. So, and how do people, they listen to your show, Dave. That's how they figure out what's going on.
Well, these kids will know your email address tomorrow morning. So.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, part of the discussion that we're having with Jerry Isdale and Ed Wright tomorrow is about DYI opportunities on nanolabs and cube labs. So we hope to have a workshop out here in the Bay Area in the months ahead that focuses on this technology and says, not only how, you know, you can get involved or your groups can get involved for educational things, but also how can your groups get involved for as entrepreneurs?
I've got another question for you. And again, listeners, phones are always better than email. 1-866-687-7223. Alan is in Houston, Texas. And he says, so you're talking mostly technology, CubeSats, small sats, things of that nature. That's fine and dandy, but NewSpace also talks about opening the frontier and having access to space for the regular folk, not just government-trained astronauts.
Yeah.
But you're not talking about that part of NewSpace at all. Do you do anything that comes with a link between the two sectors, or are you only on the robotic side?
Well, I think part of our vital space effort is about, you know, what's going to happen with the people that fly. And if you look at a group like Astronauts for Hire.
Right. They've been on the show lots of times, too.
Yeah, for Brian Shiro.
Yeah,
I mean, that,
good
that
friend.
That's an effort that, you know, people can join. And if they want to be Astronauts for Hire, I mean, I think Brian's got to work on how they're going to put their business model together, but I've had several discussions with him on that effort. And, you know, it's the inflection point for the new space industry are the 500 tickets that Virgin Galactic has sold and, you know, continuing to sell. It's going to be the people that fly in space that are going to be the real game changer, in my opinion. And there are opportunities to design experiments that can fly on those vehicles, whether it's Virgin Galactic or X-Corps or Dave Mastin's Space Systems. And then for those people that can figure out how to buy their Virgin Galactic ticket, you know, you can go up and participate. And I would say even, you know, right now, through things like Citizens in Space or the NASA Flight Opportunities Program, it's an entrepreneurial mindset that's going to get you up there. If you wanted to, you could buy out the whole Virgin Galactic vehicle for $1.5 million and figure out what it is that you're going to do on the Virgin Galactic field. Very much like if you wanted to get a ticket to fly on the zero G vehicle, you can go do that. And whether it's a crowdfunded effort, you need to be thinking as an entrepreneur. And because the tickets are out there, the opportunities are out there.
We've got a caller. Let's see who wants to talk to you. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
Hi, guys. This is Doug from Southern California.
Hi, Doug. Go for it.
All right. You know, a lot of the space-related companies that seem to be moving forward are focusing on small things like CubeSats or bite-sized components or services. You know, I think about 3D printing or Sticky Boom, you know, just
right.
Sort of small things. And it seems to me as though these are, most of the things that are getting funded are the small things. However, it seems to me as though that there is sort of one outstanding exception to this, and that is the asteroid mining. It seems to have gone, I think, a different path, and that is where you have an approach that really wasn't crowdfunded. It wasn't,
right.
You know, it wasn't somebody making a pitch to sort of hard-nosed venture capitalists who are, you know, saying, well, you know, software versus hardware, you know, software is less expensive to develop. I mean, these guys are a hardware company, really, ultimately. So for people who have sort of these big ideas, does the PRI path suggest, I mean, is there an alternate path to realizing big ideas?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, if you look at, I think what you're referring to is the Planetary Resources.
Yeah.
Where that effort has actually come out of Planetary Sciences Institute, and those guys have a direct role in mission, and that, for instance, like the Dawn mission. And so they've just gone and visit Vesta, you know, the Dawn has gone and visit Vesta, and then it's on its way to Ceres right now. And to me, what Planetary Resources represents is a dialogue between the technologists and the moneyed interests, where it's Larry Page and Eric Schmidt from Google, and so they've put, you know, some resources behind that company, and you have the technologists working with financiers to make something happen. You know, I'm not privy to the individual details and strategy of Planetary Resources, but I see it, you know, if you're dealing, for instance, with, you know, NanoRacks, there are a number of companies that have successfully gone out and raised levels of angel funding and, you know, VC funding. I mean, that's a Planetary Resources is almost at a very deep pocket angel level.
Right.
But, you know, to the extent that the community is warming up to that and it hasn't developed into a frothy internet-type bubble activity yet, but that, you know, that's probably in the offing on this. And I think if you come up with the right idea and you've got kind of a demonstrated track record and you've got a team that that people can believe in and you can tell a compelling story, which is kind of the Skybox story, you know, there's money out there for the right ideas, because investing in new space is not, you know, you can't put all your money behind social networking. You want to make sure that you've got an investment portfolio where your investments are not correlated. And new space represents an opportunity where it might not the ups and downs of the social networking industry may not coincide with ups and downs in new space. So, and you know, if you have any thinking about the matter, you're always welcome to send me an email. I'll be happy to, you know, discuss things with you on this. But you know, there are groups like Near Earth LLC, Hoyt Davidson is out in Connecticut now. He was in New York. Hoyt led up the New Space Business Plan competition, but Hoyt Davidson and Ian Fichtenbaum are part of Near Earth LLC, and as I understand it, they led the initial angel round for NanoRacks.
Would you, is Near Earth, help me understand, is Near Earth the same thing as NanoRacks, or is Near Earth sort of another asteroid mining company?
No, Near Earth is an investment bank.
Oh, I see.
Right. So Near Earth is Near Earth with, you can look it up, Hoyt Davidson and Near Earth LLC. Those guys are out in Connecticut, and they serve as, they are positioning themselves as intermediate between angel rounds and VC rounds. So, you know, and if you listen to Bert and Lee talk about, you know, the investment environment, there's, you know, initial angel rounds, there's friends and family angel rounds, and then up to the VC rounds. And there's, if you talk to Hoyt Davidson, he'll say, well, there's kind of a gap between what an angel can do and where the VCs want to start. And, you know, can they fill in that intermediate range? So, and then if you look at efforts like the Space Angels crowd with Joe Landon and a number of those guys, they, you know, their goal is to connect businesses up with the angel community. So it's possible, but you've got to have a good team. You have to understand what the market is, and you've got to have a good story for how people are going to get a return on investment.
Right. But if the return on investment, you know, if it's sort of like, give me a relatively small amount of money in a relatively small period of time, I'm going to return you this return on investment. You know, that's sort of the story that venture capitalists like to hear. But the idea of, you know, give me billions of dollars, but I promise you $10 billion in return, well, that is a very hard sell.
Yeah.
And I'm not quite sure that Planetary Resources is really making that pitch, because they're going a very interesting, relatively small approach and a small team and imaging and things like that before they jump all the way to asteroid mining. So they've thought that through.
Right. So you've got to have that kind of bootstrap mentality for what are you going to do early on, because if you're asking for a lot of money, you know, to do this, you know, system that, you know, doesn't have any intermediate milestones, that's going to be a tough sell.
Yeah.
But I think that's part of the art in doing this, and you know, that people come up to me and say, you know, yeah, we need this outrageous amount of money to go do this, and there's no intermediate steps, and you're like, you know, we need to go back and rethink this whole thing.
Yeah, right.
So, but
all right, well,
yeah, but my sense is that, you know, from like Planetary Resources, people are getting an inkling that there are opportunities in the new space industry, and then how can they get involved?
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you for.
And you know, if you have any other questions or anything, you feel free to send me an email, and I think David's got my email, and happy to have further discussions on any of this. So certainly, if you have any ideas for what you're thinking about, we'll certainly be happy to talk to you about it.
I'll probably do that. Appreciate it.
Great. Yeah. Sure.
Thanks, Doug, for calling in.
Sure thing.
Listeners, if you want to call, there's still time. The toll free number is 1-866-687-7223. Has Hoyt got New Earth LLC going yet? Do you know what their status is?
I mean, from what I understand, they've been going very well, and that you know, I first had an inkling for what Hoyt was doing, in, you know, prior to the financial meltdown. And then they've had agreements with NASA to provide smart customer support on a variety of issues. And last time I saw him at the New Space competition, he told me that they were moving their offices from New York to Connecticut. And I think NanoRacks is continuing to move forward. They had a press release that they had signed a deal with the Saudi Arabian Technical University for providing payloads up to the International Space Station. And, you know, if anything, I think people just need to become aware of the opportunities that are out there. And to think, I mean, you've got guys like, you know, Zach Manchester for his CHIPSAT effort, where he's, you know, crowdfunded 70K all the way up to, you know, NanoRacks raising money for the, you know, angel rounds for the support of their company, X-Core raising money for their company, and you know, I think we're all waiting for powered flights out of Virgin Galactic, but you know, that's going to come too. So, and it's you know, having been on the SOFIA program and seeing what 15 years of development looks like, I think that the new space industry is moving along at a pretty good clip. And my reading is that it's continuing to gather momentum.
I think it is changing, I think it's growing and having momentum as well.
Yeah, I would even
very different.
Yeah, I would even add that, you know, not to focus on small satellite stuff, but I'm pretty keen on those opportunities. There's a presentation out here just today on lunar CubeSats and talking about the kinds of science missions you can do within the context of the lunar environment using small payloads. And with that presentation, and people could look it up, it was put together by Ron Cox of Fletcher Engineering out of Maryland. It's actually out here, and I believe it's going to be online later on in the month. But one of the fellows from JPL gave a very nice presentation talking about interplanetary CubeSats and how they were flying perhaps a 6U mission going out and looking at Mars and asteroids. And I really do think that this is, during the 21st century, we're going to see a tremendous amount of interest in our own solar system, not just with planetary resources and mining asteroids, but within the context of how scientists understand planetary formation, that results like the Kepler mission are going to give us not just thousands of examples, but with other European missions and other missions by NASA and elsewhere, we're going to go from thousands of planetary systems to tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands, perhaps even to a million examples that from the Kepler statistical survey, their data indicates that there should be about 160 billion planets. I mean, this sounds like Carl Sagan, but 160 billion planets locked in orbit around stars in our galaxy, of which I think it's 500 million should be in the habitable zone where liquid water could exist on the surface of those planets. And I think the 21st century is going to be about, the next 50 years are going to be about understanding planetary systems, much like how we understand star formation and how stars collapse and evolve onto the main sequence. We have almost no data about how planetary systems form. All of these missions over the next 50 years are going to tell us more about how planetary systems form. And then we have to look at our own solar system and see how does the data within our gases, our rocky planets, our gas giants, our frozen planets, the dwarf planets, how does that fit within the context of developing theories for planet formation? And so I think that's been a missing piece of star formation that we just don't have any data on. And over the next 50 years, we're going to have lots of data on it. It's going to be a very exciting time. So a very exciting time for understanding how planets form, why life forms within solar systems, what's possible, and then how do we interpret the data that we have on our own solar system for how it fits in within these developing theories. So I think it's going to be a very exciting time, and then using small payloads to go explore the solar system, very exciting.
Absolutely. I find it hard to imagine what the industry is going to be like in 5 years.
Yeah.
I mean, it is changing so definitely rapidly, lousy grammar there, but I mean, it is really moving.
Well, you know, David, I gave a talk down at UCF a little while ago, and you know, I'm a graduate of Chicago, and I did my time up at Yerkes Observatory, and Yerkes Observatory was the home of Bill Morgan, who developed his Bill Morgan, Mr. Morgan, as we used to call Dr. Morgan. Mr. Morgan is the M in NK spectral classification. It's Morgan and Canaan. And Mr. Morgan developed the classification system that we all used. And between 1890, when Yerkes was formed, there were about 4,000. Angelo Secchi had about 4,000 stars cataloged in his star catalog in Europe. And between 1890 and 1920, the Draper catalog grew from those initial 4,000 sources up to a quarter of a million. And that's when Mr. Morgan started his spectral classification program. By the time they got to 1940, the catalog had grown to about half a million objects, and we had the inkling of what was the star formation process. In the mid-30s, they developed the theory of nuclear fusion for why stars burn. And we are, right now, the Kepler data has got about 2,000 planetary candidates. We're not even at the Angelo Secchi level of stellar classification yet. And so if you just look at how this is going to play out over the next 50 years, my bet is that we're going to have radically better understanding for how planetary systems form, because we'll have a whole bunch of examples, very much like you need to see what nature does, and then you develop your theories around that. And that it's going to place our solar system within the context of these more sophisticated theories. So, you know, if you're an astronomer, planetary systems is where it's going to be. That's what the first part of our 21st century is going to be about. It's going to be phenomenal, and we'll have JWST flying in a couple of years, and we'll understand a lot about planetary systems there. And you know, who knows what we're going to have over the next 50 years, but we're going to have a much better understanding about our own solar system in the relationship to other planetary systems that we just haven't been able to do.
This may be the final question of the evening.
Sure.
And this is Barbara in Salt Lake City. And Barbara says, I continue to hear about all of the CubeSat and NanoSat activity. Are we going to see an overcrowding of low Earth orbit because of the proliferation of small satellites?
I think this is going to be an issue that's going to be carefully managed by everybody. If you look at Tim Benedictus's SkyCube satellite, he's one of the things he's working on is deorbit technologies, and you know, I think we're going to have a much better handle. If you look at Zach's ChipSat effort, ChipSats actually helped to solve the orbital debris problem, such that you could fly a ChipSat on your whatever it is, your satellite, and it will continue to report where its position is so that you can track it. We're going to have to manage this problem like all other problems, and I have the utmost confidence that within the industry we'll be able to handle this problem successfully so that we don't put an artificial barrier in the growth of the industry. You could say we don't want to fly any CubeSats and just put the kibosh on all this development, but I think it's going to be a terrible loss. For if you're a fan of Clayton Christensen's disruptive technologies, CubeSats fit very much into that paradigm. So, and I think the benefits of carefully managing the industry, carefully managing flight opportunities, are going to win out rather than just saying, no, we can't fly anything.
From what I've heard from people at the SmallSat conference, that it pretty well already is self-policed. I mean, you don't get to choose your own orbits and the duration of how long you're going to be up there. Apparently there's a committee or some way of determining what it is your CubeSats are going to do and where they're going to do it. And it seems to me like the makings of self-policing of the industry are already in place.
Yeah, that is That is correct. But, you know, I would worry that, you know, people get into the debris management problem too hastily and put artificial regulations where they're, you know, regulations are needed. People need to adhere to the rules of the road.
Traffic management is needed, but
right.
But you're right. It could easily become extreme.
Right, but I think that, you know, if you look at things like the FAA office, you know, Ken Davidian is part of that office, and you know, I think that the government regulations seem to be responsive to the requests of industry. And I think the CubeSat technologies are going to offer a lot of promise for low-cost missions in the future. It's going to—I was talking to one of the guys up at headquarters, NASA headquarters, and his comment was one of retail. He said, you know, you need to look at retail astrophysics, which is how can you do missions that combine the best of commercial practices or commercial resources with the kind of science you want to do going forward. And we need to have a very healthy commercial satellite industry such that we can do very cost-effective science missions over the next 50 years. We've got to bring the cost down for doing science missions. We've got to look to alternative technologies. We need to partner with a successful commercial space industry to do our programs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Any closing comments? How do you want to leave us until the next time you're on the show?
Well, I would say if people are interested in commercial space, then certainly they can join us on Facebook. We have a Silicon Valley Space Center has a Facebook account. If you go to our svsc.org webpage, you can friend us on Facebook. You can join us on LinkedIn if you're interested in being a member of a Silicon Valley Space Center. You know, please, you know, join our organization, and shoot me an email if you'd like to have further discussions about entrepreneurial activities. I'd enjoy talking to people, and you know, we can see what we can do to help people along in their concepts. For profit, nonprofit, space, anything. I'm kind of a game for whatever people would like to talk about. So.
All right, well, keep us posted, and when you have some new developments or new information to share with us, let me know, and we'll do some more programming and keep it in the forefront.
Yeah, thank you very much, David. It's always a pleasure to speak with you, and, you know, thank your listeners.
Always a pleasure to speak with you as well, and I thank the Comcast gods for making our show possible. Listeners don't know that, but we almost didn't have a show tonight due to Comcast. So,
such is the nature of things.
The nature of things. They came through. That's exactly right. Until the next time, Sean, and I will be in touch with you after I talk to my fifth grade class in Missouri tomorrow, because I'm going to give them your contact information, and
absolutely,
then I'll follow up with you. And maybe you can get them interested in doing a real project instead of just talking policy and engines and stuff.
We've got, in closing, we've got a couple of projects. We've got time on RGSAT. I've got a chipset that I've got to fly with Zach Manchester, and then I have a spectrometer I've got to fly as part of NASA's Flight Opportunities Program. So we didn't even get into all that, but we're working our hardware projects too. So
okay. You'll hear from me sometime tomorrow, and thank you a lot for being on the show. And listeners, Mars Drive comes back on the show Friday morning. Frank Stratford, all the way from Australia, via the phone, of course. Always good to talk with Frank, and then open lines again on Sunday. Everybody have a great week. Thanks to Dr. Sean Casey and all of you for participating and listening. Good night from the Space Show.